Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
We've now increased our visibility on the road. If you have traveled, if you ask those who travel on that road today, you will see patrol teams moving. And I was on that road back yesterday. By this time, I was on that road. This morning, again, I was on that road to ensure increased visibility of security men on that road.
Nigerian authorities say security forces have killed more than 200 armed gangs, known locally as bandits, in 4 days of gun battles in central Niger state.
The amount of abuse, the amount of suffering, human suffering, is devastating. We are hearing stories of women who have been abducted, raped. We are hearing stories of children who have been forced into the war and girls who are missing.
Hundreds of thousands of Mozambicans displaced by attacks from Islamic State-linked militants in northern Cabo Delgado province.
Botswana continues to walk in the path provided by multilateral environmental agreements that she is party to. However, with limited resources, filling these commitments continues to remain a challenge. But we stand committed as Botswana. Do not doubt it.
And at the UN's Environment Assembly last week, over 100 nations pledged to negotiate a binding treaty to reduce plastic pollution. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian authorities say security forces have killed more than 200 armed gangs, known local as bandits, in 4 days of gun battles in central Niger state. Nigeria has been struggling to contain growing violence by armed groups known for mass kidnappings for ransom. Timothy Abiezu reports from Abuja.
The Niger State Commissioner for Local Affairs and Internal Security, Emmanuel Umar, made the announcement during a press briefing in Mina, the state capital, Wednesday. Umar said the bandits were killed in gunfire exchanges with agents at various locations between Sunday and Wednesday, and that operatives recovered scores of motorcycles and cattle. The commanders of the gangs were also killed. Additionally, he said, two officers were killed by the bandits and that injured personnel were receiving treatment. During a televised interview with a Lagos-based television station, he said authorities were increasing the security presence on highways in the state.
We've now increased our visibility on the road. If you have traveled, if you ask those who travel on that road today, you will see patrol teams moving. And I was on that road back yesterday. By this time, I was on that road. This morning, again, I was on that road to ensure increased visibility of security men on that road.
Authorities attributed the victory to a joint task force operation, including local militias and community heads. Nigeria has seen a rise in mass abduction and killings by bandits since late 2020. Thousands have been killed in violence and tens of thousands have been displaced from their homes. Early this year, Nigeria's armed forces said they killed 537, quote, armed bandits and other criminal elements, end quote. Monde Bala Koyes is Niger State Commissioner of Police.
And we are collaborating with all the stakeholders, all the communities, to give us vital information, that is intelligence as to their movements, so that we can nip in the bud earlier on. And we are also collaborating with our neighboring states, the other security agents in other neighboring states like Zamfara, Kaduna, Sokoto and Kebbi.
Late last year, Nigeria labeled bandits as terrorist groups, allowing for stricter measures under the country's laws. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Beheadings, abductions, and entire villages razed These are the stories told by Mozambicans displaced by attacks from Islamic State-linked militants in northern Cabo Delgado province. The four-year conflict has left nearly 4,000 people dead and displaced 800,000, half the province's population. Rwandan and Southern African troops have raised hopes for an end to the conflict. Kate Bartlett reports from Montebuzo in Mozambique.
Nine-year-old Rahima Musa is quiet and withdrawn amid the other boisterous children at this rural school in Montepeche in northern Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province. Musa and her mother fled here last year after masked gunmen came to their town of Mozamboya de Praia and began killing people, including her brother. They are some of the more than 4,000 people living in the Nikuapa camp after fleeing Islamist insurgents. Kilin Otieno is Chief Operating Officer with Joint Aid Management, JAM, an African aid and development group that is helping the displaced.
We are faced by thousands, hundreds of thousands of IDPs, internally displaced persons, who are victims of conflict around the Cabo Delgado province, especially from the areas of Machibo de Praia and Mueda, where insurgents have actually attacked and driven out thousands of people, most of them being children.
The displaced in Nikuapa camp tell brutal stories of how the Islamic State-linked militants attacked their villages and murdered their relatives. 62-year-old Zara Alifa Asumane says 2 years ago in Mozamboya de Praia, the militants killed her sister, cut off her tongue, and placed her decapitated head at the family's front door. Asumane's young nephew witnessed his mother's killing from where he was hiding under the bed, but the militants discovered him and took him. He's never been found. 57-year-old Issa Pedro's 16-year-old daughter was also abducted as they fled in an attack on the town and was never seen again. Aid group JAMS Otieno says their stories are all too common.
The amount of abuse, the amount of suffering, human suffering, is devastating. We are hearing stories of women who have been abducted, raped. We are hearing stories of children who have been forced into the war and girls who are missing.
Like many in Nikuapa camp, 32-year-old Issa Amir says he doesn't understand why self-declared Muslims are killing other Muslims in the north of this mainly Christian country. Amir says even some of his friends and family have joined the militants. He says when the militants in 2019 came to Mozamboya de Praia, they said we'd better leave because when they came back, they would kill everyone. When they did attack, says Amir, many people were killed. Their motives may have more to do with greed than God, says Amir, as some young men become insurgents thinking they'll get rich. Most people live in poverty in Cabo Delgado, despite it having Africa's most valuable known gas fields, worth an estimated $60 billion. Security analysts say the militants are recruiting the disaffected youth who have seen no benefit from the oil. Jasmine Opperman is a Johannesburg-based security and terrorism consultant with the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. She says the deployment 6 months ago of Rwandan and Southern African Development Community, SADC, troops has helped Mozambique fight the militants.
Has Rwanda and some succeeded in pushing back the insurgents? That they had some degree of success cannot be negated. But to argue that they've successfully pushed them back is a complete oversimplification. And this is what the insurgents have done, splitting up in small cells, spreading the battlefield and moving, retreat, regroup, and then move back into the battlefield area to attack.
Mozambique, Rwanda and the Southern African nations have vowed to stop the insurgents. SADC and Rwanda have so far sent more than 3,000 troops to Mozambique. South Africa's military in late February said it was sending fresh troops and armored vehicles and insisted the insurgents were withdrawing. Mozambique's displaced. In camps like Nikuapa, can only hope the insurgents are soon defeated so they can one day return home without fear of more brutal attacks. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Montepeche, Mozambique. We'll be right back.
The United Nations Environment Programme marked its 50-year anniversary Thursday at its headquarters in Nairobi, Kenya. Activists have criticized the organization as being slow to address global threats to the environment, such as pollution and climate change. But at the UN's Environment Assembly last week, over 100 nations pledged to negotiate a binding treaty to reduce our plastic pollution. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The United Nations Environment Programme marks 50 years this week. The agency's chief, Inga Andersen, said Thursday the agency has contributed to saving the planet from harm and destruction.
We saved millions of lives and protected nature. We showed that environmental multilateralism does deliver. That is a lesson that should inspire us today. Friends, there have been other major achievements. The launch of the scientific body, the IPCC, the phase out of lead in petrol, and just yesterday, the resolution starting the pathway to a global plastic pollution deal to end plastic pollution for good.
The resolution calls for 2 years of negotiations towards a comprehensive international treaty on how to handle the growing problem of plastic waste. The UNEP was formed in Stockholm in 1972 and has been a key player in safeguarding the world's planet, species, wildlife and climate. The UNEP was formed in Stockholm in 1972 and has been a key player in safeguarding the world's planet, species, wildlife and climate. The organization says its mandate is to bring the world together in tackling environmental threats, addressing leaders, delegates and environmental activists at the UNEP headquarters in Nairobi. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta praised its work.
Progressively, over the last 50 years, UNEP has led the world understand the centrality of environment in human existence, to appreciate the increased threats to the environment and also the existential threat that exists to our planet. They have also helped us galvanize collective global action to protect our environment.
Wanjira Maathai, the Vice President and Regional Director at the World Resources Institute, said enforcing agreed-upon environment policies and laws has been a challenge.
I think enforcement is usually our biggest challenge because we make commitments, but we don't always follow through with the enforcement. And I think that's the biggest opportunity for us, is to see them through.
Botswana President Magwetsi Masisi says implementing environmental laws and the agreement requires greater funding.
Botswana continues to walk in the path provided by multilateral environmental agreements that she is party to. However, with limited resources, filling these commitments continues to remain a challenge. But we stand committed as Botswana. Do not doubt it.
Andersen said her organization needs the support of all countries to achieve and deliver a stable climate and rich nature that benefits all. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Refugee aid group Refuge has hosted a virtual international fashion show in East Africa for female refugees. Organizers say the show's proceeds will go towards helping women and girls who are seeking refuge as they flee conflict in East and Central Africa. Brenda Mlinya reports from Nairobi. She is a very
strong. Elizabeth Yah appears at home on the catwalk. The dress she wears for this year's Refugee Fashion Challenge bears her name and tells the story of her young life.
What is in front here is like a necklace. So in our culture, when you receive your menses, or like your period, like your family give you a very long necklace. If you are coming from a rich family, it's long, longer like this. And if you are from a humble background, it should just be shorter.
Yah Gideon was 13 when she fled her native South Sudan 10 years ago to escape an arranged marriage. She had not yet received her necklace, but the Refugee Fashion Challenge gave her a chance to experience the tradition. Designer Monica Canary says fashion can help others appreciate the repressive cultures many of the girls experience.
And I said, you know, we're going to give Yah the longest jewelry possible because her value, her worth, does not come from the external, It does not come from your circumstance or what happens, but it comes from who you are within you.
Yah Gideon is now pursuing work as a fashion model and designer. Refugee's goal is to help refugee girls and children adjust to their life in Nairobi after arriving from conflict-stricken countries, as Yah Gideon once had. The nonprofit organization offers education, economic training, and emotional and mental support, and it takes a holistic approach through fashion design.
The girls in our program get to work here. They are able to earn an income and learn business skills and leadership skills. So these designs are hand-dyed by the girls in the program. They come up with the creative designs, and each design is named after the girl who came up with the design itself.
Kanari says the fashion event shows what is still possible, no matter how bleak things may appear.
Sometimes you think, I'm doomed. It's over. This is it. I can't play. I can't be a little girl anymore. I have to be a wife. I think it's very important for every young person to be given that message that, you know, don't be limited by the circumstances that come to you. If you are willing and you can find a way, take that opportunity to leap forth into something else.
The proceeds from the event will go towards helping thousands of girls who seek refugee aid in Nairobi, Kenya. Brenda Mulinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
Chinese tech giant Huawei is in talks with South Africa's Labour Ministry over infringements of the country's employment policies that require 60% of staff to be local hires. Experts weigh in on what a settlement could mean for Huawei and other foreign businesses operating in the country. Linda Jivtash reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's Labour Ministry says Chinese tech firm Huawei is non-compliant with the country's employment policies. The ministry's Employment Equity Act sets requirements for the number of local hires, including those of disadvantaged backgrounds, at various levels within a corporate structure, and it does regular checks across industries for compliance. Bakiswa Nkanka Bede is a lawyer for South Africa's Department of Employment and Labour.
There is a room to employ foreign nationals, especially on companies or employers that come to the country to invest and also to transfer skill to the South Africans. We do allow them to bring 40% of their employees. You realize that 90% of its workforce, that is Huawei, is foreign nationals.
The Labor Department launched legal proceedings against Huawei earlier this month. On Friday, the ministry confirmed it was in settlement negotiations with the tech firm on how to correct the discrepancies. Huawei did not respond to requests for comment. Bede says the government's actions should send a signal to all companies that noncompliance will not be tolerated.
We are not targeting Huawei, but we are also coming for the big companies in South Africa because we want to ensure that transformation does not just become a talk, but it must be seen as a reality. Transformation means even if you employ South Africans, who are these South Africans that you are employing? Are they addressing the imbalances of the past?
The Employment Equity Act aims to correct historic inequalities in the country, including racial preferences from the apartheid era that benefited white workers. But those regulations are not playing out as planned in the workforce. Komatsu Mutsunabi is a law lecturer at the University of Johannesburg.
There's rampant violation of these regulations by big companies and small companies and South African companies, international companies. I would definitely say in relation to all of our labor laws, there's an enforcement problem. I think that the Department of Labor is under-resourced.
In addition to inequities, South Africa is experiencing rampant unemployment, with upwards of 35% of people being jobless. Musunabi says it's even worse among the country's youth.
I think that government is trying to make an attempt to ensure that South Africans are employed, but not only that South Africans are employed, but that they acquire sort of the globally relevant skills that they need to compete in international markets, particularly tech skills.
Companies that are non-compliant face fines, but labor lawyer Joannette Reeder says for companies as big as Huawei, those fines are a drop in the bucket and unlikely to have a broader chilling effect.
In South Africa, there's in many businesses also an attitude of we will fix it when we caught out. Bigger businesses that's got a better social conscience, if I can call it that, do comply. The middle size and the smaller businesses who just can't afford to comply with all of these legislation. So they basically fix it when they're caught out.
Instead, she says bridging education and skills gaps in the country, rather than going after foreign workers, is the best way to address unemployment and inequity.
The biggest thing that we can do, in my view, in this country is to upskill people. There are some strategies that is in place, but it's always the struggle between upskilling our local people and not giving jobs to foreigners.
The Labor Department said talks with Huawei are expected to conclude Friday. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Ghana's rapid urbanization is producing more waste while fueling a boom in luxury housing that the average Ghanaian cannot afford. One entrepreneur may have the answer to both problems. Producing inexpensive houses made from recycled plastic. Senator Todd reports from Ghana's capital, Accra.
The real estate market is booming in Accra. Luxury communities continue to spring up in prime locations across the Ghanaian capital. Realtors say the boom in luxury properties is fueled by the changing demography and growing economic activities in the capital.
I think it started off from the oil sector in the late 2000s. When Ghana discovered oil. So I would like to believe that there was almost like a gold rush to Ghana at the time. So a lot of developers decided this was the best time to position themselves. So then they capitalized on that by getting multiple acquisitions and started investing it.
Ghana's growing economy is driving up migration to its cities, where many Ghanaians find themselves competing for decent and affordable accommodation. The 2021 population census revealed that Ghana needs about 2 million additional housing units to completely accommodate its 30.8 million people.
The deficit that we are talking about is in the lower, medium to lower income brackets. And we don't seem to be doing well in that area. The average estate developer is unable to meet the price points for this category of people.
But whether people are living in luxury or affordable housing, they also find themselves facing a common problem: plastic pollution driven by population growth. But plastic houses may be a possible solution to both problems. Nelson Boateng is building houses made of bricks from recycled plastics and is doing so at a fraction of the cost of concrete buildings. His one-bedroom apartment cost $11,000 and was made with 13,400 kilograms of plastic waste.
And we advance in producing plastics, Lego bricks, to build affordable housing for the very low-income Ghanaian. The bricks are not because it's very cheap, the durability is less. It's stronger than the normal concrete bricks that we have, because these bricks can withstand waterlogged areas, can withstand earthquake, and doesn't burn.
Nelson mixes shredded plastic waste materials with sand under high temperatures to mold the inexpensive building bricks. The bricks have worked well for one-story buildings, but to lower cost and accommodate more people, he must find a way to build high-rising buildings.
So we thought of, why don't we develop a different pillar corner mold that can carry 2-3 stories? So that is what we are working on now.
The Ghana Standards Authority says test shows that Nelson's building blocks meet quality standards.
It passed the compressing strength, just as the ordinary concrete blocks and things also pass. So the product is of good quality and can serve the same purpose as the traditional products.
Nelson hopes his homes made from plastic waste will catch on with the Ghanaian public. Even better, perhaps forward-thinking luxury real estate developers will turn to using the plastic bricks when building their next high-rise. Sena Anutod for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Netline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. And in Netline Africa sports, the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022 Africa qualifiers will be concluded this March with the holding of the final round. 10 teams are still in contention for the 5 African places at the prestigious World Tournament. The first leg of the last round is scheduled for March 25th, while the second leg matches will be held on March 29th, 4 days later. In contention is Mali, who hope to win their first ticket for the World Cup. For countries like Cameroon, the African nation holding the record for participation in the World Cup with 7 appearances, or Nigeria with their 6 appearances, it will be a question of extending their records. Morocco and Tunisia have participated in the World Tournament 5 times and hope to return to the world stage. It's 3 participations each for the Black Stars of Ghana and the Pharaohs of Egypt. For African champion Senegal, it will be a 3rd participation in World Cup after 2002 and 2018. As for Algeria, they are aiming to revive after an early elimination from the TotalEnergies Africa Cup of Nations 2021. DR Congo, then Zaire, got a glimpse of World Cup in 1974. Now, 48 years later, the Leopards are ready to return. And Eritrea have pulled out of qualifying for the 2023 Africa Cup of Nations, giving their opponents, Botswana, a bye through to the group stage of qualifying. The two sides were due to meet in a 2-legged preliminary playoff this month, with the first leg scheduled to be hosted by Eritrea on March 21st and the return match 8 days later. The Confederation of African Football confirmed both legs had been cancelled after it received a letter from the Eritrean Football Federation announcing its withdrawal. A reason for the decision has not been disclosed. Eritrea's men have not played a senior game since a friendly against Sudan in January of 2020, and their last competitive outing came against Namibia in a World Cup qualifier in September 2019. The South African country also withdrew from this month's second round of qualifying for the Women's Under-17 World Cup. Ivory Coast will organize the 2023 Nations Cup, with 5 other preliminary ties set to take place later this month. The group stage of qualifying is scheduled to begin in June. The 2021 edition of the Nations Cup was held in Cameroon earlier this year, with Senegal winning their first ever title. Meanwhile, Ethiopia held host Uganda to a 2-2 draw in the first leg of the second round in the Under-17 Women's World Cup qualifier. After going 2 goals down in the second half, the visiting Ethiopian team fought back strongly to pick an important draw at the St. Mary's Stadium Kitende on Thursday. And lastly, in the Women's Basketball World Cup 2022, Nigeria's the Tigress, who have won the past 3 African titles, have been drawn alongside hosts Australia, Canada, France, Japan, and Serbia in Group B. The USA, bidding for their 4th consecutive Women's World Cup, will face Belgium, Bosnia, China, South Korea, and one other side in Group A in Sydney. Russia had qualified for the tournament, but world governing body FIBA has excluded Russian teams and officials from its competition following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. As a result, the final team to compete is yet to be determined, with a decision expected on March 25th when FIBA's central board holds its next meeting. The top 4 teams in each group will proceed to the quarterfinals at the tournament, which will be held from September 22nd to October 1st. The Americans, ranked number 1 in the world, swept past Japan to clinch a 7th straight Olympic Games gold last August and have won a record 10 World Cups. And that's about it for this edition of Netline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict and in time of peace. Here is one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As the international community continues to express its outrage at the evolving war in Ukraine, African leaders, and in particular the African Union, should use its best efforts to focus on what is now occurring in Libya, a member of the Union. In previous commentaries, we have already examined the origin of the tragedy in Libya. We have also looked at the various efforts to mediate the crisis. But as we know, the impasse continues in Libya. And now there is a new development which has the risk of complicating the crisis. As you may recall, efforts were made to have election last December. Now, it has not been possible to do that, and to deal with the situation, the parliament in Tobruk has decided to replace the prime minister in Tripoli, which is recognized by the United Nations, and appoint a new prime minister. The new prime minister have just placed before the parliament his cabinet for their recognition so he could proceed. On the other hand, the prime minister recognized thus far has said he would never release his mandate in Tripoli and would continue. He is expecting that he will get support from those Western countries in particular that have recognized his previous government. There are hints that the United Nations may continue to support the government in Tripoli. The Secretary General Advisor on Libya, Ms. Williams, in recent days have been trying to determine whether she could bring the parties together to avoid a new devastating crisis. It is not certain that she may be able to do that. In the circumstances then, African Union in particular should not sit idly by as Libya develops into a deeper chaos and bloodshed. It must find a way to show more interest in the negotiations. Thus far, those playing the key role in the search for peace are not Africans or the African Union. And let us be frank, we have seen that the outside states' interest and the competition for resources in Libya had complicated issues and made it difficult to find a peaceful solution to the agony of the Libyan people. I know that there might be hesitancy in the African Union to return to the Libyan issue, given the fact that in 2011, there were serious and determined efforts to push the African map out of the way. But it is not wise to sit back and allow outside powers to deal with an African problem that have remained unresolved since 2011. This is why the call must come to the African Union to redouble its efforts and pursue ways and means where it could be involved in trying to find a peaceful resolution in Libya. Otherwise, Africa will become the only continent in the international community that will remain a playground for great power rivalries. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday here on Headline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Mawa. fight, make a fight for the love. It's not curse, make a curse for the love. No one, no complication. This is a situation. It's not curse, make a curse for the love. It's not fight, I go fight for the love. Every superwoman is a superman. Your love give me joy when you know it, you understand. Fine girl, you don't need no other man, no other man. Your love give me joy when you know it, you explain. Girl, I wanna give you good love and love no other. You with the bust of my medulla, you with the rise of my temperature. I wanna give you sweet love and love no other. You with the bust of my medulla, so now you with the rise of my temperature. My doctor say my journey they on top your body, yo. All the times where I do you bad, I'm sorry, yo. Give me love way better pass money, yo. Where sweet pass honey, yo. If not fight, make a fight for the love. I grace, make a grace for the love.
That was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a very good evening.